The authorities in Niger say 55 people have died in an oil tanker explosion near the airport of the capital city, Niamey. Niger's head of civil protection, Boubacar Bako, said the tanker had tipped over and people were trying to take oil when the explosion occurred. The French telecommunications giant and its former chief executive are going on trial in Paris, accused of moral harassment linked to a spate of suicides among employees. Six other former managers at France Telecom, now renamed Orange, face the same charge. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
10 years ago, unions at France Telecom warned of a surge in suicides among the company's 110,000 staff. It's calculated that in just 2 years, 35 employees took their own lives, some leaving messages blaming France Telecom and its managers. At the time, the newly privatized company was in the throes of a radical restructuring. It needed to shed more than 20,000 jobs. The prosecution's case rests on the charge that the company deliberately introduced management methods which it knew would drive some staff to despair.
A ceasefire appears to be in place between Israel and Palestinians in Gaza after 2 days that saw the fiercest clashes between the two sides in years. There's been no official announcement so far. The BBC's Tom Bateman is in the Israeli city of Ashdod.
What we have now is a lull, a tentative calm, after what amounted to really the worst flare-up between these two sides in recent years. As for what happens next, well, we know that there has been an intensive effort by the United Nations, by the Egyptians, by the Qataris, also the European Union, to try and ensure there is not a return to hostilities. And that ceasefire does seem to remain in place for now. But when you speak to people here, and as for ordinary people in Gaza as well, many people seem resigned to the fact that it is only a matter of time until things resume again.
World news from the BBC. The Sri Lankan authorities have deployed additional troops to the city of Negombo following clashes between Muslims and the majority Sinhalese. The flare-up late on Sunday started out as a traffic incident before escalating into mob violence. Some vehicles were set on fire and a few houses were damaged. A curfew imposed overnight was lifted and state schools reopened amid tight security after the Easter Sunday bombings. But these parents didn't feel ready to send their children to school. I've decided not to send my son to school until the country returns to normal. There is security in the school. However, until we're certain about the situation outside, we won't send our children to school.
After the incident on the 21st of April, the security services have told us that security's been re-established. Whatever they say, for my peace of mind, I kept my child at home.
Investigators in Russia are examining the wreckage of a plane that crash-landed at Moscow's main airport on Sunday, bursting into flames and killing 41 people. 9 of the survivors are being treated for burns and inhaling toxic smoke. The pilot of the Aeroflot Sukhoi superjet has been quoted as saying that lightning hit the plane. Malaysia has extradited a former Goldman Sachs banker to the United States to face charges in relation to the disappearance of billions of dollars from the Malaysian state investment fund, 1NDB. The Malaysian citizen, Roger Ng, is accused of laundering money diverted from it. Goldman Sachs is under scrutiny in the U.S. after raising money for the Malaysian fund. Millions of people have queued up to vote in India in the fifth phase of a staggered general election. More than 87 million Indians across 7 states are eligible to take part today, including people in Jammu and Kashmir. The Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is hoping his record on national security will win him a second 5-year term. BBC News.
Hello, I'm Rita Iqbal. Welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. It comes to you live from our studios in central London. In a moment, a UN warning that up to 1 million species of plants and animals are at risk of extinction because of human activity. That's our top story today. We'll also be in India for round 5 of the world's biggest election and later in the programme.
5, 6, 7, 8. Round your back, lift your stomach and lift your knees off. And go.
Well, it's 100 years since Joseph Pilates developed his unique exercise method while in an internment camp in the UK. It's now practiced by millions. Do stay with us for those stories. Lots coming up this hour. We begin, though, with nothing short of a crisis. Life on Earth is under assault. The planet's life support system is failing nearly everywhere.
The various forms of non-human life, collectively known as biodiversity, are in decline. Humans are transforming Earth's natural landscape so dramatically that as many as 1 million plant and animal species are at risk of extinction. That top line emerges from a 1,500-page UN report that's taken 3 years to put together and has been compiled by hundreds of international experts. The full report will be published this year, but a summary of its findings has been crucially approved by representatives of more than 130 countries. The conclusions are bleak and stark. The abundance of plant and animal life has fallen by 20% over the past century, and its human activities, farming, logging, fishing, mining, which are changing the natural world at an unprecedented rate. Professor Eduardo Brondizio is one of the report's lead authors.
What we are showing here is that the rate of biodiversity decline has accelerated significantly during the past 50 years. We are estimating that in terms of biodiversity, for instance, today, we have about 500,000 species that are threatened with extinction, up to the range of 1 million species.
Is it possible to focus on one or two species that will give an illustration of what impact is actually taking place in terms of a bigger picture? Is it possible to say that if this species of bird, insect, etc. is lost, this will happen?
You look at pollinators. 75% of the global agricultural production depends on pollinators, right? So when we start to have fast declines in pollinators, the economic and the social impacts are immense, right? So the estimated impact on the loss of pollinators, for instance, range from $250 billion to $500 billion a year.
All of this is happening because of the way in which we are changing how we use land. Is that right?
We're talking about land, we're talking about freshwater ecosystems, and we're talking about the ocean. So we have estimated that we have significantly altered 75% of the terrestrial environment, 66% of the oceans, 85% of wetlands. That scale of impact is having consequences. The main direct drivers of change that have led to this situation are, first one is indeed land use change and sea use change, particularly in coastal areas, followed by the direct extraction of resources, right? Harvesting plants or animals in the estuaries, or the rate of fishing that we have, followed by climate change. So climate change is already having an impact on biodiversity, which is in fact projected to increase according to our scenarios. Key driver is pollution of different kinds, and the fifth key driver is invasive alien species.
Let's focus a little bit on the expertise of indigenous communities around the world who live in the most biodiverse regions, the Amazon rainforest, for example. How can they help to preserve the biodiversity, especially in the context of Brazil, where a president has been elected who really is making already a big impact on those indigenous communities, and that is a real threat to them?
Their role in this conservation is central. They are safeguarding, and they have safeguarded nature for us, and are, you know, sort of a central part of advancing to more sustainable ways in the future.
Obviously, people around the world are increasingly aware and focused on the impact of climate change and what we need to do to slow that right down. Are you arguing in this report that the threat to biodiversity is a silent crisis that we haven't really focused on enough?
That is a good way to put it. To put in simple terms, it's a death by a thousand cuts, if you will. It has been relatively invisible from our both personal and larger agendas. Part of it is that a lot of those changes happen away from where we live. You know, one of the things that we see during the past 50 years is that the areas of productions and consumptions have become farther and farther apart. So we demand resources from distant regions without incorporating and without thinking about the impacts that we have both on local societies but also on biodiversity and nature.
Is it your view, or does the report also suggest, that those people who are impacted by this the most are not just
the places where the production of food is changing the way in which we use the land. But it's a myth to say that the only people who will be impacted by this are people in poorer countries.
We are all affected. Whether we live in Paris, whether we live in São Paulo, whether we live in a small town, you know, when we open our tap water, we depend on ecosystems far away. So whether you live in a city or whether you live in direct contact with nature, we're all depending on that.
Eduardo Brondizio, co-lead author of today's Global Assessment Report on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. Well, indigenous people are some of the most affected by that bleak scenario, but could also hold the key to some of the solutions, as we heard from Professor Brondizio. I've been speaking to Valerie Courtois. She is a member of the Innu Nation community in eastern Canada, who traditionally live alongside the caribou reindeer. What's she particularly worried about?
I'm from the region of Labrador. My nation is the Innu Nation, and our people are very much caribou people. And we've been sounding the alarm about the health of our species, and in particular, the health of our caribou populations for the last number of years. And this report is really, really just another confirmation of the things that we're seeing on the ground.
And tell me what you are seeing on the ground.
We've seen a decline in our caribou. So the local migratory herd here that we mostly depend on is known as the George River herd. That herd in the early 90s was numbered at least 800,000 animals, if not a million. The latest census of that herd 2 years ago has them numbered at less than 5,500 animals. And for us, that's a devastating number. It means that we really cannot depend on the caribou for our subsistence and for our food security in the same way that we have for generations.
And what is it that's causing the decline in the population?
What we're seeing with the caribou is an increase in insect harassment. For caribou, there's nothing worse than being harassed by an insect.
Can you just explain the insect harassment element of what you just said?
These insects tend to bore into the skin of the caribou. It's enough to drive caribou up into the mountains and into the hills, an area where there is much more wind to drive the insects off, and they'll choose that wind over choosing good food. They will sacrifice their nutrition in order to escape those insects, and that affects both how they move, the timing of them moving, and also just generally their stress level. So caribou, when they're stressed, tend to have lower body fat and therefore lower rates of survivability, lower calving rates, etc.
Okay, but the insects have come about as a result of what? So they didn't exist before?
Climate change is absolutely driving the insects north. So we're seeing here in the north in Labrador an increase of insects, period, which is enough to drive the caribou to change their migration and be stressed enough to actually have an impact and a measurable impact on their population.
Okay, so the decline of the population of caribou and also the fact that they're being driven further north is having a cascading impact of what kind on other species?
On our species, on the Innu, it's having a drastic impact. It's completely changed our diet and the way that we've been able to utilize our territory. Our entire cycle of land use really revolves around the cycle of caribou, and with this decline, we've had to think about it and change where we go, the timing when we go, and in fact, it's meant that all of the nations who depend on that herd have signed on to a management strategy to reduce the harvest level of these animals in order to make sure that they can indeed rebound from the impacts of climate change. And, you know, our men become men by hunting caribou. And so we may very well, if considering these declines can last 30 to 40 years, be in a situation where we have generations of young men who aren't actually matured to a point where they can become leaders in our community.
So this is having a direct impact on not just the way of life, but on the very specifics of culture of the Innu people.
That's right.
That was Valerie Courtois. We'll be returning to the story before the end of the program. Let's turn to Russia now and the Aeroflot plane, which on Sunday made an emergency landing just after takeoff in Moscow. 41 people died. Dramatic video footage shows passengers using emergency exit slides to escape the burning aircraft. Let's speak to the BBC's Moscow correspondent, Sarah Rainsford. Sarah, what's the latest on what caused this?
Well, the investigation is obviously very much underway. The teams have found the two data recorders. There's people in white suits picking through the carcass of that flight. The plane is actually still lying on the tarmac at Sheremetyevo Airport. And obviously that the investigation is hunting for clues. They've come up with a few theories. In fact, it's quite a long list of possible reasons. They range from the qualifications of the pilot and the crew and the traffic controllers right through to the condition of the plane itself, and also questions about the weather conditions at the time. Now this comes as the pilot himself has been speaking and talking about the plane being hit by a lightning strike, and saying that threw all the electronic communications on the plane and cut all communication with the ground. So that's obviously going to focus, I think, the direction of the inquiries from now.
And there's been some talk about passengers stopping to collect their things from overhead lockers. Is that all true?
Well, it's not 100% clear. Certainly there were some reports. And if you look very closely at some of those extremely dramatic pictures from the tarmac as the back end of the plane was in a ball of fire, you can actually see that some of the passengers do have luggage as they come off the plane down the inflatable slide, which is extraordinary, because if we look now at the scheme, a plan of the plane, and look at where people died and where people survived, it's quite clear that the back rows of the plane, that's where the passengers lost their lives in the fire, and the people at the front of the plane are those who got out. So questions about whether some may have impeded those at the back and stopped them getting to the emergency exits.
Sarah Rainsford, our correspondent in Russia, joining us live there from Moscow. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Razia Iqbal. This is NewsHour. Coming up, it's 100 years since the exercise method Pilates was developed in an internment camp on the Isle of Man.
In the camp, he spent a lot of time watching the cats, the monk cats, that were just walking around in the camp and moving, and he really analyzed the way they were moving, and then he started developing exercises based on what he had been watching the cats do.
More on the extraordinary life of Joseph Pilates later on in this programme. The BBC News headlines this hour. As you've been hearing, the UN has published the biggest ever study of global ecosystems, warning that up to 1 million species are at risk of extinction because of human activity. And more than 50 people have been killed by an oil tanker explosion in Niger. This is Razia Iqbal with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. Now, it's the fifth round of polling in India's general election. There's voting in seven states today, including the largest, Uttar Pradesh, and Ritula Shah is there for us. Ritula.
Welcome to Lucknow, an Indian city once ruled by Nawabs or princes, and now the capital of Uttar Pradesh, which, with a population of 230 million, is the largest of any state. And that's the thing about Indian elections, the numbers are astonishing. In total, 900 million people in 29 states have the chance to vote. Across the nation, there are more than 2,300 political parties and more than 1 million polling stations, each with its own electronic polling machine. Indian elections are multi-layered affairs. Religion, class and caste, that's India's strict social hierarchy, all play their part. Powerful regional parties jockey for support alongside the big national ones. Well, children are playing on the swings and couples are taking an evening stroll in this tranquil corner of the city, except for the geese. I don't know if you can hear those. I think they might be having their dinner and they're being very noisy. But elsewhere, Lucknow is dotted with ornate 18th century buildings put up by those Nawabs. And it also has a vast pink sandstone monument, more
more than one, I think, created more recently by a leader of the Dalits. Those are people who are deemed to be the lowest members of the caste system. But when it comes to national elections, Lucknow is a stronghold for the ruling Hindu nationalist BJP. I've been finding out more about the election prospects of the BJP and the party's leader, Narendra Modi, and those also of the main opposition Congress, led by Rahul Gandhi. On Sunday evening, it's still very hot outside, and it's even hotter where I'm standing. I'm in the centre of Old Lucknow, in front of what's called the Chalk, which is the oldest part of the city, beautiful mix of old buildings and new buildings. It's chaotic. But in front of me, there are about a dozen men, and there is the clash of hands, the heat of massive bars, in which all kinds of food is being cooked, and there's a man taking naan out of a tandoor, which is an old clay oven. It is an extraordinary scene, and this is the kind of place that people in Lucknow hang out in on a Sunday night. I'm here to talk to Sarat Prasaran, a local journalist, about this election.
Interestingly, the election began with key issues like unemployment, like poverty, corruption, development. But as the election has proceeded, the real issues have gone in the background, and the political parties are going hammer and tongs on communal issues. This time, even religion is being used full-throatedly.
In 2014, the BJP won by a landslide, massive majority. Yeah. Are they going to win by the same margin again?
I really doubt that. And probably the ruling dispensation has also realized that it is not, the mood is not the same. That was a kind of wave, a Narendra Modi wave, clearly in 2014, which took him to the hilt. Of late, the kind of language that he has been using shows some kind of desperation in the man. He never talked communal in 2014. He talked of development, and people saw him as some kind of a messiah of the country, because there were a lot of problems in that, the earlier Congress regime, and the corruption was a big issue. They thought that here is a man who would really transform India into a new modern India. But in 5 years, that has not happened.
The chilies are very strong. I think they could catch you both our throats. Okay, that's Narendra Modi. What about Rahul Gandhi, leader of the Congress, the main opposition leader? Does he make the same impact? Does he cut the same sort of figure with the public?
No, sadly not. Rahul Gandhi comes out as a nice, well-meaning human being, but not someone who has it in him. But you know, India is not a presidential form of government, democracy. And you don't need to vote in the name of an individual, but that is what is happening in India.
Local journalist Sharat Pradhan talking to me last night. It's now Monday morning, which is of course voting day here in Lucknow. It's the fifth phase of this mammoth election in India, and there's still two more to go after this. And as Sharat was telling us, this is a presidential system. In India, voters elect a representative to the Lok Sabha, that's the lower house of parliament. And Uttar Pradesh, which is the state I'm in, sends 80 out of a total of 543. And basically, winning big here means you've got a very good chance of running the country. So I've come to a school in the northern suburbs of Lucknow. It's called the Maharishi Vidya Mandir School. It's a polling station. There's a big dusty square outside the school, which has got a couple of amazing trees. There's a mango tree with green fruit and a rather beautiful Gulmohar tree, which has bright orange flowers. And you desperately need those in shade because it is so hot. And here's first-time voter, Jyotsna.
I'm very excited. I think the Modi is the winner.
You think Modi is the winner? Why do you think he's the winner?
He's the best for nation.
Not for Jyotsna.
No, my friend, Masi.
Masi, oh, you're her auntie. So you come together?
Yeah.
So you
She's my sister.
The family outing, hello. Yeah. So did you all vote for Mr. Modi today?
Yes, we are for Modi. We are for Modi.
Everyone.
He's a real hero.
Namaste. You voted, sir. You've got the mark on your finger. Why did you vote and who did you vote for?
Bhrashtachar pe Modi ne ankush lagaya. Desh ki tarakki ke liye unhone kaam kiya.
He fought against corruption. He supported everybody. There's development everywhere. That's why we support him.
My name is Anju Chaurasia. My duty is election committee ki taraf हैंडीकैप की हेल्प के लिए हम लोग यहाँ पे हैं। हम लोग का संगठन एक समूह है जो कि
she says we're a group that actually goes out and helps in case of natural disaster, but for the election duty we're here to help handicapped people.
So it's an effort to get everybody to be able to vote. You're very recognisable. You've got some lovely yellow waistcoat on. Has it been busy this morning? There seem to be a lot of people here, but it's very calm.
नहीं सुबह से तो बहुत अच्छा रहा है. सुबह से हम लोग ये लोग 6:30
It's been really good since morning. We've been here since 6:37. Mostly people tend to come early. It's slowed down a little bit now because of the heat, but people will come back in a little later. What stops people from voting?
किसी का रोड नहीं बना है, किसी का कोई काम नहीं हुआ, इसी वजह से थोड़ा सा दिमाग में रहता है.
She says, yeah, maybe they're not happy with the candidate, or the road around their home's not been built, or they were promised something and it's not been delivered. So there is a section of society that doesn't come out and vote for that reason. But that 10-20% is what we're targeting, and maybe next time there'll be 100% turnout.
That's Anju Tarasia helping to get the vote out in Lucknow. And there were an awful lot of people helping to get the vote out, actually. It was quite impressive. And it is interesting. Lucknow is a BJP stronghold. I spent quite a lot of time talking to people at that polling station. And everyone who was willing to speak to me said they'd vote for the BJP. I went to another polling station where quite a few people actually there were critical of Narendra Modi's party, but they were really circumspect in how they expressed themselves. They weren't comfortable about making their criticisms within earshot of people who might support the Prime Minister and party leader. It was a telling detail. Having said that, I have to stress, this is just a snapshot of one small corner of this vast and varied country. Other factors maybe to think about? Well, historically, India's a country that likes to shake things up at election time. So that may work against the incumbent BJP. And also a lot of campaigning now happens at big rallies, as traditionally it's always done. But it's also gone online, viral videos and songs being shared on social media. Who knows what impact that might have? And the issues that people bring up repeatedly, the demand for more jobs, the need to tackle poverty and better personal security. Women bring that up a lot. I'll be finding out more about some of those themes in the days ahead, and also looking at the prominent role of Hindu nationalism in this election and what that may mean for 170 Muslims who live here. Razia.
Well, I look forward to that. Thanks very much indeed. That was Ritva Shah and Team NewsHour joining us live from Uttar Pradesh in India.
Now on the BBC World Service, fairy tale meets high tech. The indigenous people of Arctic Norway have a rich tradition of storytelling.
In the Sami culture, we had lessons about a troll which we called Stallo.
But in this story, it's not a troll or Stallo that lives deep within a snow-capped mountain.
Wow, it's like we're driving into the bowels of the earth.
The Sarangari is the cooling station.
For a massive underground data center. 90% of the world's data was generated in the past few years, and it's all got to be stored somewhere.
More than 35 billion things will be connected to the internet shortly.
But the huge hydroelectric dams needed to power and cool these servers are at odds with the Sami, who want to protect their traditional land.
In modern political discussions, people can say, I feel that the government is behaving like a Sami, taking over resources.
Dark fibres and the frozen north. At bbcworldservice.com.
Coming up here on NewsHour in the next 30 minutes, we'll be in Venezuela, where our correspondent has been speaking to the opposition leader, Juan Guaido, on the impetus of the protest campaign against President Nicolas Maduro. Also, President Trump threatens China with new trade tariffs. And the man who invented the Pilates exercise system 100 years ago while he was in an internment camp. First, the latest world news. BBC News with Julie Kendler. A landmark UN report is warning that humans are rapidly destroying the natural world, upon which our health and economies depend. Scientists found that a million species are facing extinction over the coming decades, mainly because of human activity. They say halting the process will require a fundamental reorganization of people's consumption. 58 people have been killed in Niger in an oil tanker explosion near the airport of the capital Niamey. The authorities said the tanker had tipped over and people were trying to take oil when the blast occurred. A French telecommunications giant and its former chief executive are going on trial in Paris accused of moral harassment linked to a spate of suicides among employees. Investigators accuse France Telecom of instigating corporate policies aimed at undermining employees and provoking anxiety as part of efforts to cut the workforce. Sri Lanka's government has deployed additional troops to the city of Negombo following clashes between Muslims and the majority Sinhalese. The flare-up late on Sunday started out as a traffic incident before escalating into violence. A curfew imposed overnight was lifted on Monday. The International Criminal Court says Jordan will not be the site of the UN Security Council for failing to arrest the former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir on war crimes charges. The split decision by the five-judge panel reverses a previous order. Malaysia has extradited a former Goldman Sachs banker to the United States to face charges in relation to the disappearance of billions of dollars from the Malaysian state investment fund, 1MDB. The Malaysian citizen Roger Ng is accused of laundering funds diverted from 1MDB. And Buckingham Palace has announced that the Duchess of Sussex and wife of Prince Harry, Meghan, has gone into labour. There will be announcements made soon. BBC News. Welcome back to NewsHour. China-US trading troubles next, but first, in January, Venezuela's opposition leader Juan Guaido declared himself interim leader, arguing that President Nicolas Maduro's re-election was invalid. Mr. Guaido has been recognized by more than 50 countries, including the United States and several European nations. Mr. Maduro has the support of Russia, China and Cuba. Despite months of sporadic protests, Juan Guaido has failed to persuade the army to oust Nicolas Maduro. And although Mr. Guaido urged his supporters to rally outside military barracks this weekend, only a small group turned out. He insists he's gaining support. He's been speaking to the BBC's Nick Bryant in the capital, Caracas.
You have tried now three times to overthrow President Maduro, and you have failed three times. Are you worried that this is undermining your personal leadership?
I think the only one that really hurts himself is Maduro. It has been losing again and again. He's increasingly weak, increasingly alone, has no international support. On the contrary, we gain acceptance, support and future options.
But he has the support of the military.
Part of him. Partial, obviously, part of them, not all.
The Trump administration has said it is considering military action. But at the end of the week, President Trump himself spoke about humanitarian aid. Are you worried that Washington's position is softening?
President Trump's position has been decisive at this time, without half measures, but simply accusing not only what has been the most severe complex humanitarian emergency in the region, 7 million Venezuelans, 25% of the population, at risk of death, recognized that figure indeed by the United Nations.
What specifically would you like to see the Trump administration do? Would you like to see them intervene militarily?
That question is very important because today in Venezuela there is a president in charge and a national parliament that is looking for change. The only intervention that exists today in Venezuela is that of the Cubans, which needs intelligence and counterintelligence to our armed forces, and also the intervention of Russian military aircraft on Venezuelan soil. I believe that it is not unresponsible to evaluate it, given the crisis and tragedy that Venezuela is living through, but to maintain an alternative if the regime intends to continue radicalizing a process that has brought us to this disaster. I, as the president in charge of the national parliament, will evaluate all options if necessary.
The opposition leader there, Juan Guaido of Venezuela, speaking to the BBC's Nick Bryant in Caracas. Lots on the background to the Venezuelan crisis on our website, bbc.com/news. And if you are really short of time, there is a little feature in there, Venezuela crisis in 300 words. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour.
This is NewsHour. Our main story this hour is that a million different species of animals and plants are facing extinction because of human activity, according to the UN. Representatives from 130 nations approved the most comprehensive assessment of global diversity ever undertaken in Paris today. The report has found that nature is being eroded at rates unprecedented in human history. But the chair of the multidisciplinary UN panel, the IPBES, behind the report, and Larry Galdery, stressed that the main message was one of hope.
We have not lost the battle, and if given a chance, nature will reconquer its rights and will prevail. And so we really want everyone to feel that they can contribute, that they are part of the solution. And this is very much the main message that this report is bringing to the world. So our goal, all of us, is to really elevate now the topic of biodiversity, to really bring it at the same level as climate on the top of the agenda of policy makers.
Well, we'll find out what hope there might be when we visit the Cayman Islands later in the program. Let's move away from that story now. And another example of policy by Twitter today. President Trump tweeted that he will increase tariffs or taxes on Chinese imports. Duties imposed on $200 billion of goods from China would increase from 10% to 25%. He appears to be setting a new deadline to produce a deal or trigger an escalation in the now year-long US-China trade war. Shares on Asian stock markets fell sharply after President Trump's threat. Let's speak to Meredith Crowley, who is a professor of economics at Cambridge University and an expert on international trade policy. Meredith Crowley, let's go back to the beginning and get you to explain to us what the talks are about. What sort of deal is it that the two sides are trying to get to?
So the United States' fundamental problem economically with China is twofold. First, we're unhappy with what's known as state capitalism or socialistic capitalism that's practiced in China. And also the U.S. is unhappy about the protection of intellectual property in China. So the first problem is fundamentally the U.S. government is concerned the Chinese government subsidizes production of all different types of things by giving firms money directly or by giving financial support to firms in sort of not very transparent ways. That makes Chinese firms very competitive against firms in the United States. It also gives Chinese firms a bit of an economic advantage over U.S. multinational enterprises that locate in China in order to sell to Chinese consumers. That's the first problem. The second one is when U.S. multinationals locate in China, they form partnerships with local Chinese partners. And oftentimes they're required or they're just asked to share some of their technology with their local partner. That is probably fine from the American perspective if the technology stays within the U.S.-China joint venture. But Americans have accused, in many cases, Chinese partners or other Chinese entities of somehow getting American technology and using it without crediting the original American firm.
Okay, so when President Trump tweets that on the $200 billion worth of trade, he's going to increase the taxes from 10 to 25%, what's your analysis? Is he bluffing in order to produce a particular result in the negotiations, which everyone assumed were going relatively well to date?
So the negotiations have been going reasonably well, but I think it's been leaking out that the United States isn't going to get the important types of structural reform on state capitalism and technology transfer that have been the key economic problems the U.S. has had with China for the last 15 years. And so he started to get a little bit of criticism even before the final deal was announced. And so I think in that regard, he realized, oh, wait a second, people are going to be critical of me. Maybe I should start to ask for more. And it seems very unlikely that the Chinese are going to make real substantive changes in this last week of negotiations.
Is it your view that when President Trump presents the tariffs to date as making an impact on China and China bearing the burden of them, is it the case that that's true, or is the impact of those 2018 tariffs, have they been passed on to U.S. consumers in the form of higher prices?
So we have a recent economic study by the New York Federal Reserve, Columbia University, and Princeton University, and that has found very strong evidence that 100% of the tariff increase is being passed on to U.S. consumers and businesses in higher prices. So Americans are bearing that higher price of this trade war. It's also the case, though, when prices go up, people buy less of whatever's being sold. And so on the Chinese side, Chinese producers are having a harder time selling to Americans because of the high tariffs as well. So the cost of the trade war, of any kind of trade disruption, is borne by both parties. And that's why it was always a foolish enterprise to go into a trade war without a very clear vision of how you would end it.
And do you think, in the light of the tweets, just very briefly, whether the next phase of the talks is still going to go ahead?
I think the talks will go ahead. I think we'll probably see a deal. The question is going to be whether it's a substantive deal that really addresses problems, or whether it's a sort of superficial deal with a bunch of headline-grabbing, modest concessions that don't really do very much for the long-term relationship.
Meredith Crowley, Professor of Economics at Cambridge University and an expert on international trade policy. Very good to have you on the program. Now, 100 years ago, during the First World War, the British government sent anyone they deemed an enemy alien or a threat to national security to internment camps. Most of them were Germans living in the UK. One of them was an exercise fanatic, a man called Joseph Pilatus, who spent time in a camp on the Isle of Man, a small island between mainland UK and Ireland. It was there that Joseph Pilatus developed an exercise regime which he called Controlology, but has since, of course, been dubbed Pilatus, and there are now millions of practitioners. I've been speaking to Eva Rinker, a German historian who has written a biography of Joseph Pilatus. I've asked her first. Joseph Pilatus is often described as having been a sickly child. Was that why he was so interested in exercise from a young age?
Actually, I think that's one of the stories he told about himself which are not perfectly true. But at least I didn't find any evidence that he had been a sickly child. And I must say that three of his siblings died. At that time in Germany, there was a huge mortality of infants. And so those who lived actually were the healthy ones. His father, he was an enthusiastic gymnast, and he took his son to the gymnastics club with him. And that's where Joe learned gymnastics, boxing, and also bodybuilding exercises and weightlifting.
And how did he come to devise a new form of exercise? Were the ones that his father introduced him to not good enough or lacking in some way?
He loved doing gymnastics, but he also had this really natural and intuitive feeling of the body and of motion and movement. And so he just sometimes felt that some of the exercises were not right, and he just wanted to change some things and make it more natural for the body to do those exercises. And that's when he started developing his own method.
And what were the methods based on? Because he spent time in an internment camp on the Isle of Man, and I just wonder what informed the specifics of the program that he devised.
Yeah, and this time in the internment camp was really crucial for his becoming an autodidactic developer of a movement method, because in the camp, he later said he spent a lot of time watching the cats, the Manx cats that were just walking around in the camp and moving, and he really analyzed the way they were moving. And then he started developing exercises based on what he had been watching the cats do. And he did those exercises, and he taught his fellow internees those exercises. The internees, they were so, it was so difficult in the camp, they didn't have anything to do, and so they loved doing exercises with him. This was a way he could try things. So when he came back to Germany, he really changed his career. Before that, he had been a brewer. And then he became a sports teacher, he opened a boxing gym, and he also started developing apparatus for his exercises.
How did he end up going to America?
In the first period of his life, like the first 40 years, he changed locations
so many times. And sometime in the 1920s, he ended up in Hamburg. He was working there in rehabilitation. He was also teaching self-defense training to policemen. And there he met, at a boxing match, he met Ned Fleischer. Ned Fleischer was the editor of the Ring magazine, of the famous Ring magazine, and he was from New York. And he actually told Joseph Pilatus to come to New York and to try his luck in the United States. And he just told him that he would have much more success with his method and it would be a good starting point.
I suppose we should make it clear that it was, he never called the approach Pilates himself. Where did that come from? Who called it Pilates?
He called his method Contrology, because the method was all about control, learning to control your body, control your muscles, to get to know your body better. It just turned into Pilates because people were talking about going to the Pilates studio, and he became this legend in New York City, and people were talking about him. So the method was finally named by his surname.
And do you think he had a sense of how enormous the potential was for this kind of exercise?
Absolutely. I mean, even when he designed his first patent, he had them patented in several countries. When he was living in Germany, he had them patented in several European countries, in the United States. Then he moved on to the United States, and his plans were huge. Like, he was planning for world fame. And he was really, actually, he became quite depressed towards the end of his life by the fact that he didn't succeed on such a big level as he had imagined. And he used to say, well, I'm 50 years ahead of my time. And that's actually what happened with his method. So success came much later.
I've just been looking at photographs of him from when he was in his early 50s and comparing them to when he was in his 80s. And he clearly looked like a man who was utterly determined and committed to the preservation of his body.
Yeah, I think that was his focus in life. Like, he was not interested in anything else. Like, working out and moving his body and being his body, feeling his body, that was all he did, that was all he cared for. Actually, this was complicated for other parts of his life. Like, he didn't care so much for his relationships. He didn't care so much about other people. He was not good at socializing or things like that. But he really put all his effort and all his attention into his body.
Eva Rinker on Joseph Pilates. Two bits of breaking news to bring to you. The Dow Jones Index has tumbled more than 450 points after that new tariff threat by President Trump on Chinese imports. And for those of you who follow this stuff, a Buckingham Palace announcement. The Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle, has given birth to a baby boy. £7.03.
This is the BBC World Service, finding out whether massive data centres could be the key to Norway's continuing prosperity.
Wow, like we're driving into the bowels of the earth.
The sound that we're hearing is the cooling stations.
For a massive underground data centre, 90% of the world's data was generated in the past few years, and it's all got to be stored somewhere.
More than 35 billion things will be connected to the internet shortly.
But the hydroelectric dams needed to power and cool the huge servers are at odds with the indigenous Sami people as they try to protect their traditional lands.
Dark Fibres and the Frozen North is at bbcworldservice.com. And in 10 minutes, it's Hard Talk. Here's Stephen Sarko.
An exclusive interview with Britain's Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt at the end of his tour of Africa. What has the protracted Brexit crisis done to the UK's global standard?
Now back to NewsHour.
And a reminder of our top story this hour. The UN has published the biggest ever study of global ecosystems, warning that up to 1 million species are at risk of extinction because of human activity. NewsHour spoke to Eduardo Brondizio, one of the report's co-leaders.
75% of the global agricultural production depends on pollinators. So the estimated impact on the loss of pollinators, for instance, range from $250 billion to $500 billion a year.
One other headline this hour, the Duchess of Sussex and wife of Prince Harry, Meghan Markle, has given birth to a baby boy. Buckingham Palace said in a statement, the child will be seventh in line to the throne. is Razia Iqbal with News Hour live from the BBC in London. Let's go back to our top story now, the UN report, which is a warning 1 million species face extinction because of human activity, an existential crisis which will have devastating consequences for humans also. We can speak now to Fred Burton, who works in conservation on the Cayman Islands, and he's been involved in trying to save the blue iguana. Cayman Islands are in the Western Caribbean Sea, south of Cuba, northeast of Honduras. Welcome to the programme, Mr. Burton. Tell us about the work that you have been doing trying to save blue iguanas. Well, first of all, tell us why they needed saving. How many of there were there?
Well, we got to the point, we did a survey thinking there would be a couple of hundred still. We discovered there were about 10 or 12 left in the wild. It really was right on the very edge. They're a beautiful, large, bright blue lizard with red eyes, quite charismatic. And so we were fortunate to be able to get a high level of interest in our work to bring it back from extinction.
And how did you do that? What was it that you needed to do in order to save them?
Well, the first thing was we had to figure out how to breed them and raise them in captivity in large numbers. And that took us a while to figure out. People know more about this nowadays, but anyway, we got to the point we could breed and release into the wild 100 iguanas a year. And that quickly brought us back to a healthy situation. And the key thing then was where do we put them? And this brings us back to this whole subject about deforestation and protected areas.
Before we get to that, I mean, what were they threatened by?
They were threatened by loss of their habitat, for sure, and by invasive species. Specifically, feral cats were eating all of their babies. And also, unfortunately, they were becoming very much victim to roadkill as well. So I would say dogs, cats and fast cars were their biggest threat, along with just simply loss of the places they needed to live.
And that's the deforestation that you're referring to?
Yeah. I mean, the Cayman Islands, as anywhere else in the world, really, humans are increasing the population and taking over the landscape. And it's really a bit of a race against time of establishing protected areas sufficient to make sure we don't lose all our unique local biodiversity.
What about the presence of the green iguana?
So that's a classic invasive species problem, and it's probably one of the more spectacular, because we had a few green iguanas brought into here as pets in the early 1980s, and nobody really thought anything about it, really. And of course they escaped, or people let them go and got too good to take care of, and they started to breed. And before we knew where we had 1.4 million green iguanas on this little island of 64 square miles.
And how many blue iguanas are there now as a result of the work that you've been doing?
About 1,000.
And do you hope that is a number that will increase because of the continuing conservation work you're doing?
In the short term, I think yes. In the medium term, I hope so. In the long term, with climate change causing sea level rise, we're very concerned about what will happen with all of the species that live in the lower parts of our island. A lot of Grand Cayman is only 1 to 2 meters above sea level. And if the trajectory we're on goes in the same direction, it's not going to be that many centuries before all of that is under the water.
Fred Burton, joining us live from the Cayman Islands, involved in trying to save the blue iguana. Thank you very much indeed. Let's go to Paris now and speak to our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath. Matt, are you there?
Yes, indeed.
Matt, it does feel as though it is overwhelming what it is that we're seeing here.
I think that's a fair comment, Razia. I think, a lot of these studies have come out over the last number of years. What this report has done is to pull them all together and to put the humans right in the center of those particular report, and to see just the scale of the damage we're doing across all the different spheres, be it in the sea, be it in the sky, be it on land. And as you said, when you added up, the scale is pretty horrific, and the future looks pretty fortunate for perhaps up to a million species.
Does it feel to you, though, that the report and the way in which it's been presented does also present solutions which will involve a huge amount of commitment on the part of politicians, but also all of us.
Yes, I think it does. I think that it's key to any chance of combating this kind of loss over the coming decades, that governments and individuals and corporations are all on board with it. And it requires some fundamental changes in the way that we approach things. One of the fundamental philosophical changes that people need to make, according to one of the authors, is we need to redefine what is a good life. What do we mean by a life well lived and a good life? When your children have more than you do, when the country is growing or you're growing, and all of that needs to be rethought, because there simply isn't enough material in the world to keep going the way we're doing in terms of the way that we're consuming. We're consuming 0.7 Earths at the moment in terms of materials. We only have one planet, so there's an imbalance there, and the imbalance has been taken out on species of all sorts, particularly plants and animals.
We very often speak to you, Matt, about climate change, and it's quite clear from this report that one of the real drivers in the context of the extinction of these species, or potential extinction of these 1 million species, is climate change.
Yes, absolutely. And what is really shocking about this report is that the scientists have put together a list of the five things that are driving this the most, and climate change is number three in that list. So it's not even, you know, when we talk a lot, as you say, about the scale and the impact of climate change on our planet, and politicians seem to be getting that message quite now, but the other things we're talking about here, the change of land, the increase in agriculture, the widespread, you know, changes in what's happening with the sea as well. All these things are putting pressure on the planet and on species in a way that we've really not taken notice of before. And we are now in what's been termed an ecological crisis, and climate change is continuing to make that worse. I guess one of the positives, really, is that a lot of the solutions that might work for climate change might also, in some sort of sympathy, work for saving species as well. So I guess there's some hope that a lot of the attention that's been given to climate change right now might actually drive action on saving species too.
Matt McGrath, our environment correspondent, joining us live from Paris, which is where a compelling UN assessment has been unveiled today, saying that humans threaten 1 million species with extinction. Lots on this story on our website and also on other stories that we have covered here, not least the royal baby, which no doubt everyone is going to obsess over for some time. That's it for this edition of NewsHour. Thanks very much for your company this past hour. I will be back again tomorrow. I hope you'll join me then.
Listening to the BBC World Service. And here's what's happening in the studio this week.
The composer Cedric O'Regan's latest opera, The Phoenix, has been years in the making. Hear how the music has taken shape as we follow him from the first melodies to preparations for the opening night.
In the studio. Tuesday at 4:30 and 10:30 GMT.